Going to the gym can be discouraging, especially if you're putting in the work but barely seeing changes. But with Tonal, you can actually see your progress with every workout. Tonal provides the convenience of a full gym and the expertise of a personal trainer anytime at home with one sleek system. Designed to reduce your mental load, Tonal is the ultimate strength training system, helping you focus less on workout planning and more on getting results. No more second-guessing your technique. Tonal gives you real-time coaching cues to dial in your form and help you lift safely and effectively. After a quick assessment, Tonal sets the optimal weight for every move and adjusts in 1 pound increments as you get stronger, so you're always challenged. Tonal lets you choose from a variety of expert-led workouts, from strength to arrow hit to yoga and mobility to keep you coming back for more. For a limited time, go to Tonal.com to get $500 off your Tonal purchase, plus a free 4-year warranty. That's Tonal.com for $500 off, plus a free 4-year warranty. Tonal.com.
Let's find a conversation between your soul. Let's find a conversation between your soul and the night.
Hello, Prestige Heads, and welcome to American Prestige. I'm Danny Pessner, here as always with my friend and comrade, Derek Davison. And we're very excited to welcome to the podcast today, Eva Payne. Eva is the author of Empire of Purity, The History of Americans' Global War on Prostitution, and also an assistant professor in history at the University of Mississippi. So Eva, thank you so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here with you both.
It's a very apropos day to do this book because we are recording the day after Anora won the Oscar for Best Picture. So there is a God. This demonstrates that. So Eva, let's just jump right into it. And the first thing that I want to ask you about is this notion that you introduce at the beginning of your book of this idea of American sexual exceptionalism. So before we actually dive into the book itself, could you maybe talk about what got you interested in this subject? What is American sexual exceptionalism? And how does this shape, or how should this reshape, how we understand the United States' relationship to prostitution and sex work? And also, before actually, maybe a quick question, can we just use those words interchangeably, prostitution and sex work, or should we be more specific with the term that we use here?
So historians like to sort of debate about this. In the book, I use prostitution when I'm kind of talking about the past because it is a particular legal concept as well as a sort of social concept, right? The idea that sex work is work was something these reformers were fighting against. But when I'm talking sort of as my analytical self, I'll use sex worker or person who sold sex, women in commercial sex, kind of range of things like that. But I do use prostitute and prostitution, again, because of the sort of historical specificity of those terms in the time I'm talking about.
No, that makes sense. It's a legal category. So yeah, no, it totally makes sense. All right. So what made you want to investigate this? And then let's talk about American sexual exceptionalism.
So the thing that got me to this book, this is like such an embarrassing, but after 9/11, right? It was my first, my second week of my freshman year of college.
So like, I get it.
I know, yeah. It's like such a, I don't know, mood killer. But after 9/11, I began to see really quickly all this rhetoric from people like Laura Bush, other even prominent feminists saying, it's the duty of the United States to save the women of Afghanistan, right? We have this, we're now protecting them, we're releasing them, the civilized world agrees that we have to go in and protect Afghan women. And that's really why this war is happening. Not American military and economic interests, no. It's about saving these women. And I thought, that's crazy, right? Saving women by destabilizing their country further is not what Afghan women had been asking for in their own movement for women's rights. And so I was really interested in how these ideas about rescuing women, and certainly there were undercurrents of sexual danger in all of this rhetoric, were actually really the stuff of sort of high politics, were a really powerful smokescreen, one that some feminists got on board with for extending American military and economic and political interests in the world. And so I think those questions stuck with me. And when I started grad school, I was really interested in finding ways of exploring them. And I kind of landed on some of the characters in this book. And I think that genesis of the project helps to explain what I mean by American sexual exceptionalism and why I'm so interested in it. Because I think we saw after 9/11, when America becomes this, U.S. becomes this hyperpower, this moment where, again, the U.S. paints itself as this particularly benevolent kind of empire. And that's absolutely what this concept of American sexual exceptionalism was doing at the turn of the century, when I really see it coalescing. Now, to be clear, using sex, sexual behavior, treatment of women as a kind of barometer of civilization, that's not new, right? European imperial powers had done it for a while. The U.S. absolutely did it in their dealings with Native Americans, African Americans. But I see at the turn of the century, this growing idea that the U.S. is a particularly sexually moral nation really starts to kind of undergird a sense of American exceptionalism. And certainly in the post-World War I moment, or even during the war, this idea that sexual self-control really goes hand in hand with democratic self-rule, that you have to be able to control your sexual urges and be sexually moral to have your own government. And so I think the U.S. weds those together in a way that allows them to extend their power.
And before we talk about the history of prostitution in the U.S., could we maybe pause for another second on this category of sex trafficking? Because you spend some time talking about it, and I'll just give you the opportunity, not what is sex trafficking, but maybe we could talk a little bit about the complexity of that category itself.
Yeah, I mean, I open my book with this question because I think it's really important. Part of what I'm tracking in this book is how we get the idea of sex trafficking in the United States that we sort of live with today and that absolutely shapes domestic and international policy. And so I start the book with these two visions, two different stories of what happened, right, that have really different ramifications. So one is the story of Marie, a French woman who migrates to Rio de Janeiro in Brazil and says she migrates to sell sex. She makes good money. She opens a bank account. When these undercover investigators are trying to suss out what she's doing, she's like, yeah, I'm making good money. I'm going to send for my sisters back in France so we can open our own brothel, save up a bunch of money, and then go back to France. I mean, we're starving in France, right? There's no work. And so that's one version of understanding what was happening, right? Which I would call, and she would call, migratory sex work, just like pretty much everyone from Europe, right, was doing migratory labor at this period. It was a massive period of labor migration. But then you have these American investigators who look at people like Marie and they say, well, you're selling sex and you're in a different country. That's sex trafficking, because they have no concept, right? The American definition of sex trafficking in the early 20th century sort of collapses prostitution, consensual sex work, and forced trafficking into one, so that there is no such thing. There's not a category of consensual sex work anymore. And so they take that category, right? Or they take that assumption that anytime you see someone selling sex, that is trafficking, and they run with it. And I think that's part of why I was interested in this project, is it's this time when the framework that we really are living with today gets
right.
Set.
We still live with that today. Oh my God. Yeah. I mean, that is the basic idea. All right, let's turn to the book proper. And of course, prostitution, famously referred to as the oldest profession. And so I'm sure there's lectures one can give on the history of it, but maybe you should just situate the history of prostitution in Western Europe and the United States and bring us up to the late 19th century, which is when the book really begins with this notion of new abolition.
Mm-hmm. So in the or in Europe in the 19th century, there arises, particularly in France, but it really spreads throughout Europe and its empires, this idea that prostitution should be dealt with as a kind of sanitary issue, an issue of disease control. And so that the best way to handle this is to have doctors inspect women and brothels and then license them so that they can continue to sell sex in a way that's quote unquote safe, right? So they won't spread disease. And if they are found to have disease, they're put in a prison hospital where they're treated until they can be deemed clean and then sent back to continue to sell sex. And right, they end up on this registry. And so that's the kind of European way of dealing with it. I mean, in broad strokes of sort of saying, hey, this is a kind of necessary part of the social fabric, and for men to let off, you know, these excess sexual energies and keep respectable women safe. And so we just, you know, control it through the system. Now, in the US, things look different, not because Americans are like somehow more sexually moral, but just the sort of development of the United States, right? In the early 19th century and even to the mid 19th century, there wasn't really a big, strong federal government. So there just wasn't the kind of infrastructure to make these, to pass laws about the regulation of prostitution. Now, of course, in military encampments, in cities, cities were a sort of experimenting with this European model. People knew about it, right? This international medical network by the mid 19th century is pretty powerful. And so Americans are starting to say, oh, Europeans have this kind of new system. Let's try it out. And so they implement it in some cities, but it never really takes off. It really is. It's part of the social fabric in the US, particularly in port cities. It's sort of sometimes tolerated, sometimes during kind of periods of religious revival, there are big raids on public raids on brothels. But it's just, there's just not the kind of bureaucracy and infrastructure in the United States for the most part to kind of manage it in the way that European countries are doing.
This is probably a silly question, but to me, when I'm thinking about the 19th century and prostitution, my mind immediately goes to the American West. It's become like an archetypal figure. Even if you think about Deadwood, right? So many of those characters were sex workers, and they were in a very archetypal sense. And I'm just wondering, how does expansion play into this, or does it play into it, and and then maybe before we move on to the Spanish-American War, we could talk a little bit about like race and women's rights and sort of those ideas circulating around prostitution. So to boil it down, West, race, and women's rights.
So the West is this place, again, where people around military encampments are always either trying out little forms of regulation, or there are brothels, right? I mean, where there are large encampments of men for mining, for lumber, for annihilation of Native Americans, there are women who are making pretty decent money. Again, not great money, but better money than they could doing any other occupation. And so, again, there are these little attempts to regulate it. What I do see, to kind of combine the question of the West with the question of race, is that even though the majority of women working in the West are white, that if there are outbreaks of disease, it gets blamed on Native American women very quickly. That Native American women get called dirty, and they get attempting to control their sale of sex is used as a way to control Native American populations more broadly and to surveil them. So very quickly in the West, it becomes, again, a kind of means of targeting Native Americans, even though white women are the majority of sex workers. Now, part of how race is foundational to my project is because I track a group of largely white reform-minded Americans who, right after the end of Reconstruction, right, these are all kind of former abolitionists, women's rights activists, and they say, you know what the next slavery is? It's state-regulated prostitution in the British Empire. So it's a purposeful turning away from the widespread violence against Black women, sexual violence against Black women, that is really crucial to this period of racial terror and to the rise of Jim Crow. So they're specifically turning away and they're saying, right, the idea of white women in prostitution is a worse kind of slavery because it's more unnatural, because, again, white women are inherently sexually pure while Black women are kind of always sexually available by their nature. So from the beginning, this movement is really predicated on also kind of creating racial hierarchies.
And is that emergent primarily in the northern United States, southern United States? Does it cross boundaries? Because obviously in the period of Reconstruction, this is still an intense period of sectional division. So how does that geographic space work?
So I really see it in this period as a largely, again, kind of northern white movement, kind of northeast, Midwest, and then a bit in California, which takes its very own contours because of Asian immigration. And I mean, in some ways, it's a kind of looking down at the South and again, kind of talking about how to fix it. People have described this period as a little bit of a kind of the U.S. federal government tries out sort of internal colonial projects a little bit, right, on the South, right, as this sort of other. And I see a lot of continuity, too, because Northern white abolitionists, I mean, starting in the 1830s, are really talking about slavery. I mean, yes, as a labor system, but also as a sexual system, right? One that allows men, white men, heads of household to have all of the sexual access to Black women, and that this is terrible for those white men and for their white wives, right? That it's a kind of, again, a fundamentally at its core, a sexual system. But they sort of displace, right, the critique that should be about the system and about the white men and white women enforcing it onto the Black women themselves.
Before we get into the war, the Spanish-American War, where, you know, the Philippines becomes a factor and this starts to go overseas, there's an interesting little bit in your book of history that I was unfamiliar with, which is the American interest in India in the middle of the 19th century, which kind of prefaces some of the things that happened in the Philippines. And so can you talk a little bit about, just in general, what was the attraction here? And then specifically, how does prostitution factor into this this interest in what's going on in India?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the United States, I mean, Americans had been interested in India kind of throughout the 19th century. And this is a common American pattern of sort of like piggybacking on the British Empire, right? The British Empire creates infrastructure and then Americans can go in for trade. It's the site of intense interest of U.S. missionaries. So that's part of why it becomes really important. But how it becomes really important for my project is that it is this site of very kind of visible state-run, British government-run brothels staffed with Indian women. And actually, a kind of British organization taps two American women to go do this investigation because they're able to kind of get around in different ways, right? They're outsiders to the British system, but they are trained, one of them is a trained medical doctor, and so they're able to kind of do this undercover investigation that becomes this real expose of just how badly Indian women are treated in these brothels. And so it's an important moment, I think, where Americans start to say, you know, when we go into a country, we help people, right? We're there to save our Indian sisters from the evils, both of kind of brown Indian men, but also of the British government, right? A bad kind of empire. It's bad imperialism to sort of sexually subjugate your subjects like that, whereas that's not something the U.S. does. So it is a way of the U.S. sort of positioning itself after the kind of stain of slavery and kind of coming late to the game compared to Britain abolishing slavery, to say, no, 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 but we are the real kind of moral ones because, right, we're doing these investigations, we're finding this state-regulated prostitution in India, we're trying to rescue our Indian sisters, and the U.S. government does not regulate prostitution. We are a different kind of sexually moral country.
So I think now let's move on to the War of 1898 and how this winds up playing out in the Philippines.
So the War of 1898, right, is this moment where the U.S. becomes an overseas imperial power, kind of in similar ways to Europe, and has to deal with managing administrative colonies far away. And so when the U.S. Takes the Philippines, for example, they basically just keep the Spanish regulated prostitution system in place. Now, there's been this rhetoric, like particularly around Cuba, about why the U.S. should go to war with Spain, that sort of imagines Cuba as this like virginal woman that the masculine Uncle Sam United States needs to protect. So there are these gender ideologies playing out already about why the U.S. should go to war. Again, about this sort of the U.S. is this male protector against the kind of rapacious Spain of these innocent peoples who are oppressed by the Spanish Empire. But again, when on the ground, when Americans take Manila and other cities in the Philippines, they just basically keep the Spanish imperial system of regulated prostitution with some tweaks, right? Because they have this understanding that their soldiers need to have some sort of outlet for their sexual urges, or else they might rape. And even worse, they might have sex with each other or masturbate. So again, there's a kind of sense of male sexual necessity that's a part of this. Now, an interesting thing happens, right? There are these, again, sort of intrepid American reformers who like to do investigations. And they show up, they see what's happening, and they publicize this all over newspapers in the U.S. And there is this outcry from individuals, from churches, from women's organizations, saying things like, this is un-American, right? Why are you doing this European thing in the Philippines? Like, that's why we're a different kind. That's why we should be running the Philippines, is because we're not the kind of empire that does that. And so what ends up happening is the kind of military wins the battle, I guess, in that they just keep regulating prostitution, but they make it really invisible to people on the mainland, United States. But the reformers kind of win the war, right? They solidify that public opinion is very, very vocally against regulated prostitution and has absolutely kind of rallied behind this idea that the United States is a country that does not regulate prostitution.
And how does race play into this in this instance? Because we're about to talk about white slavery, but I want to basically use race in the Philippines then to make the transition.
Yeah. So it's an interesting comparison, too, with the idea, these kind of similar groups of reformers, when they're in India and talking about Indian women, they're often talking about their sisters, right? They're really focusing on those women and their rights as a crucial part of their critique. When Americans start to critique their own government and how it is regulating prostitution, they start to pick up some of the military's language about how Filipino women in particular are dirty, are filthy, are riddled with disease, and that if white American men have sex with them, they are going to bring disease and moral decay back to the United States and harm their white wives, their children, and the nation. So you do see this shift where they get really on board with the military's very racist ideas about why prostitution needs to be regulated.
So let's talk about everyone's favorite subject, and that's white slavery. So how does this notion come to be, and how does it shape U.S. imperial imaginaries about prostitution?
So it's actually it's an older concept. It comes out of kind of critiques of wage labor and critiques of child labor. But by the late 19th century, and especially in the early 20th century, it's really come to be sort of synonymous with the idea of white women in prostitution. And it's used by British, it's used in the United States. And they're absolutely aware that using white slavery is a way of drawing on the kind of moral authority of the abolition of chattel slavery, right, in saying that, you know, we ended chattel slavery, we white people, as if that's how it went down. And now we're going to tackle this next slavery, this next worse slavery of white women in prostitution. So white slavery in the U.S., takes on its own contours, right? It's a concept that is U.S. shares with Europeans, but it takes its own, again, sort of specific ways of being politically expedient. And in the U.S., it becomes a way of talking about this ideal of supposedly innocent, virginal white women who are kidnapped, you know, into the city by swarthy foreigners or African-American men, right? These sort of ideal victims. But it also gets used in this really contradictory way of talking about European women who are supposedly being sort of taken by their compatriots to the United States to sell sex. And sometimes those women get portrayed as victims, but they also really get portrayed as increasingly as criminals, right? As dangerous to the U.S. They're going to bring in these weird European sexual practices. They're in it for the money. They're not being forced at all, right? So even as all of these different kinds of people or imagined people get called white slaves, and the laws passed to address them get called white slavery laws, there's this tension within them of protecting victims versus punishing criminals. Now, what I think is clear to me is that this tension is only kind of on the surface, because underneath, both protection and criminalization require someone else to be in charge, right? They require a protector. They require someone to make decisions for this person. They require state intervention, both of them.
So how does this campaign proceed? And it might make sense to talk a little bit about the Panama Canal Zone and how it relates to these notions of white slavery or anti-white slavery campaigning.
Mm-hmm. So the Panama Canal Zone is a really interesting example because it really highlights the kind of racial thinking that's central to these anti-prostitution campaigns. So the U.S., right, carves out the Panama Canal in 1903, and pretty much immediately, out of the Isthmus of Panama. And so to get from one part of Panama to the other, you have to cross the canal zone. So it bisects the country. And from the start, the American administration there criminalizes prostitution. They pass increasingly kind of harsh laws about it, forbidding prostitutes from even transiting through the canal zone. But because they imagine the canal zone, their hopes for the canal zone are that it's going to be this sort of white oasis, white settler colony in the tropics, to sort of prove that white Americans can live in these inhospitable climates and take charge of them. But right outside the borders of the canal zone are the two terminal cities of the canal, Panama City and Colón. And these are under sort of shared jurisdiction between the United States and the Panamanian government. And these cities have extraordinarily active red light districts, in large part fueled by workers from the canal zone. And the American administration is really keen to have those districts operating because they actually call them a safety valve for the canal, right? That let canal zone workers go to these cities outside of the canal zone and sort of blow off steam, particularly with Black West Indian women who are populating largely populating these brothels. And interestingly, the Panamanian government is really on board with this. They also want Black West Indian women to be populating these brothels because they argue that it keeps respectable, quote unquote, Panamanian women safe.
Why don't we move into the next part of the book and talk about World War One and what happens domestically in particular, I guess, as soldiers start coming back. And, you know, where does this kind of discourse about prostitution take us?
So World War One is this really important moment where these reformers I've been talking about, who are kind of, you know, they're cooperating with the state sometime, but they are independent of it, really become the state. So people in this powerful organization, the American Social Hygiene Association, it's funded by John D. Rockefeller. It has a lot of really prominent men as members. They basically, everyone in that organization joins the military and then gets put in charge of the what's called the Commission on Training Camp Activities, which is basically the whole program around prostitution control and keeping men, you know, sexually continent and doing it through sort of exercise and all these wholesome recreation things. But really, the focus of it is controlling women. And so the Commission on Training Camp Activities, right, with all these reformers in it, developed something right away that they call, later they call the American Plan as their approach. And it's a kind of three-part plan. The first is criminalizing prostitution. I mean, they say they want to eradicate prostitution and the prostitute herself. Providing healthy recreation, again, so men can kind of get their sexual energy out. And then providing what they call prophylaxis, which means treatment after exposure to disease. It's iffy on whether it works, but what's really important to them is keeping disease rates down, you know, both to keep troops available for fighting, but also to kind of, again, maintain this image of the U.S. and the U.S. military as this particularly sexually moral military, right, that's helping make the world safe for democracy. But again, in practice, what this looks like on the ground in the United States is the mass arrest of women. So these investigators go to every city near a military base and encourage local governments, force local governments to close brothels, to create more and more municipal laws, criminalizing prostitution in a taxi, criminalizing prostitution in a boarding house, allowing the police to cast a really wide net of the kinds of activities they can surveil and thus arrest any woman who looks suspicious. And the data on this is really staggering. So federal government estimates put the number of women who are arrested and incarcerated at about 30,000. If you look more broadly at women who are held in sort of local jails or state facilities, the number is likely more like 60,000 women who are arrested, incarcerated. Again, many of them forcibly treated with injections of mercury and arsenic to supposedly combat these diseases that they supposedly had, even though the testing was really had a lot of false positives. And I think an interesting comparison is that only 6,000 people were arrested during World War I for having German sympathies. So when you look at what a threat the state thought these women were, I mean, right, 60,000 women compared to about 6,000 for being traitors, it's really clear what a priority this was for the government.
And how does new social science, new techniques of social science play into this? Because you just basically reference eugenics, and this is the great flourishing of social science during the sort of later progressive era. How does this play into this? And that it might be useful. I'd love to hear what you think about this notion of progress and progressiveness, which, you know, actually has quite a bit of small c conservative implications.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I consider progressivism, right? I mean, when I teach it in my classes, I think of it as a sort of set of impulses that can go a lot of different ways. And I think that's key to how I'm thinking about it in this book, right? That it's about state intervention or state regulation. It's about social cohesion. It's about kind of improving the public. And yet, right? Who gets to decide what that looks like has real ramifications for how progressive era reforms get enacted. And so I see eugenics as a really key progressive project, right? It's about using science and technology to improve the stock of the United States. Now, I see eugenic thinking all over these investigations into prostitution. There's a woman who gets arrested in New Jersey because her cousin is a known prostitute, and they just assume that she's like them. They read women's faces all of the time and sort of say, oh, she looks simple, she has a lisp. They use that kind of what they consider data to target women and call them prostitutes and arrest and incarcerate them. So again, these sort of techniques of this idea that you can read people's bodies and faces for clear information about their character and their sexual character, as well as the idea that you can do these sort of undercover investigations and really get at the kind of social reality of what's happening on the ground so that you can make better policy around it, right? And then you do make policy. So Rockefeller actually funded two organizations. One did these investigations and the other worked on policy setting from that data. So it's a very clear progressive project with all of the kind of complicated things that that entails for that period.
And how does race play into this notion of the American plan?
So race, it really is interesting. I mean, it shows racism is really flexible. And so in some cases, Black women, Asian American women, Mexican American women are specifically targeted, really disproportionately targeted as just obvious prostitutes, really for just, you know, being on the street sometimes. Now, other times, particularly in cities in America, in the American South, local governments are really against shutting down brothels staffed with Black women because they want Black women to be in these brothels so that soldiers can visit them so that they don't seek sex with white, local white women. So it's a way of a crucial way of kind of maintaining white supremacy through the sacrifice of Black women.
Going to the gym can be discouraging, especially if you're putting in the work but barely seeing changes. But with Tonal, you can actually see your progress with every workout. Tonal provides the convenience of a full gym and the expertise of a personal trainer anytime at home with one sleek system. Designed to reduce your mental load, Tonal is the ultimate strength training system, helping you focus less on workout planning and more on getting results. No more second-guessing your technique. Tonal gives you real-time coaching cues to dial in your form and help you lift safely and effectively. After a quick assessment, Tonal sets the optimal weight for every move and adjusts in 1 pound increments as you get stronger, so you're always challenged. Tonal lets you choose from a variety of expert-led workouts, from strength to aero hit to yoga and mobility to keep you coming back for more. For a limited time, go to Tonal.com to get $500 off your Tonal purchase, plus a free 4-year warranty. That's Tonal.com for $500 off, plus a free 4-year warranty. Tonal.com.
Let's talk about the Caribbean and what you refer to as the Caribbean Laboratory and how the American plan is exported abroad. And just so people know, we're going to be talking about the Caribbean and France and how these two different contexts reshape what the American plan is.
So after, right, the American plan really gets developed. The idea behind it is it's a kind of mainland policy, largely for white people, right? A way of taking this mass of men, of new immigrants, and through the draft and through military service, making them into, socially engineering them into the white, right kind of upstanding white middle-class values American man. Now, of course, there were 2,000 African-Americans who served in the war. But white officials were a little more iffy on them, right? They didn't know that they could really make sure they didn't visit prostitutes. So they often gave them prophylaxis, right? An injection into their penis, to be clear, that they would have to hold to keep them from getting disease. So even if they couldn't stay sexually pure, they would get disease. So, right, there's a kind of white supremacy at the heart of the American plan. But by 1918, U.S. officials start to say, you know, this plan has really worked in the U.S., right? We've arrested thousands of women. We've reduced rates of venereal disease. So couldn't this work anywhere that U.S. soldiers are stationed? Shouldn't we have this one sort of uniform policy everywhere that there are American troops? And so the first place they implement it is Puerto Rico. They call it the Puerto Rican experiment, right? To see if this policy developed for the mainland U.S. might work in a place that they consider less civilized. Now, Puerto Rico is an important test case for them because were granted U.S. citizenship, was forced upon them, right? You can portray it in a few different ways in 1917. But so they are U.S. citizens, they are fighting in the military, and they think, you know, maybe the American plan in Puerto Rico can help uplift the people there. That's the language they're using when they implement it. And so it's interesting because, of course, as we know from the Philippines example, the U.S. was previously regulating prostitution in all of its colonies. That was the kind of blanket policy. And so what happens is that basically overnight, this system of regulation, right, where officials have the names and addresses of women because they are expected to submit to these regular examinations so that they can continue to sell sex. Overnight, this becomes a crime. And so there's another mass arrest of women in the Philippines or in Puerto Rico. Much like on the mainland, women are arrested, incarcerated, and they're subject to medical experimentation. So how that looks is, right, so it's this policy experiment, like, can this mainland policy work in Puerto Rico? But it's also this opportunity for access to these women's bodies who, again, have fewer rights than white mainland American women. And so they test different drug regimens on them. Like they test accepted drug regimens on them, but they intensify them. They say, you know, we want to try out, like, what happens when we push treatment as far as we can go? Because normally in private practice, someone could just leave, but these women are in jail, so they can't leave, right? So they use them again as a kind of way of medical experimentation. And this gets even more violent, I think, when it gets transported, right? They implement the American plan in the Dominican Republic. They arrest around 1,000 women there. And they try to implement it in those terminal cities of the Panama Canal Zone, right? The place that that U.S. officials previously had seen as these important safety valves for men in the canal zone. Now they were saying, you know, there should be one uniform policy. We have to civilize Panamanians and keep them from regulating prostitution. Like, look at how they're regulating prostitution. It proves that they're kind of, you know, not a real government, right? They're below us, even though, like, they didn't admit that, right? It was Americans who did a lot of the laws that regulated prostitution in those terminal cities, right? They sort of ignored that fact. And so in those two terminal cities, they did a kind of, I'll call it an experiment where they opened up the abdominal cavities of 60 women. They took out organs that they said were diseased. And then they say, wherever practicable, hysterectomy was performed. So I take that to mean they took out a woman's uterus whenever it worked for them, right? Not when the women themselves wanted them to. And so they then compare that group of women with women who didn't have their organs removed. And they find, they say, that the women who were forcibly sterilized, let's be clear, wanted to leave the red light district, wanted to go on to an honorable calling, right? Wanted to do the kind of work that makes the canal zone run, that was crucial, domestic work, laundry, food preparation, and selling. And so they almost see it as a kind of labor policy, right? A way of uplifting, supposedly, again, that language of uplifting these women through sterilization so that they can be the right kind of workers that the canal zone needed.
Yeah, incredibly progressive and eugenicist in its approach. And how does that compare to the American plan in France?
France is an interesting case because, right, the French are, Americans consider them white. They're allies. But there's kind of longstanding critiques of the French as sexually immoral, right? It exists in the American imagination, France does, as this place of sort of sexual decadence, right? There's a kind of flourishing brothel culture there. There's a kind of sexual libertinism that Americans imagine. And so during the war, U.S. officials really come into it thinking like, hey, the American plan is amazing. We have this great idea. Like, let's share it with our French allies. And so they convene these conferences with the French. And both sides are sort of horrified at each other. So the French perspective on the brothel is like the brothel is a crucial like bulwark of social and racial order, right? You have to have brothels because it keeps respectable women safe, but you also have to have brothels because there are hundreds of thousands of troops in France from North Africa and West Africa, from Asia. And so those soldiers need access to women, but they should only have access to white women in the brothels so that they will not have sex or form long-term relationships with white women outside of the brothels. So the French are coming at this with the idea that like military brothels are crucial. I mean, when General Pershing shows up and his administration, French officials are like, where should we put your brothels? Now, the Americans are horrified by this because, again, they see this as a sign that the French are not scientific, and that they're completely immoral, right? That they're not following the kind of most recent developments in medicine and public health that are also backed up by a kind of Protestant Christian morality. And so they, at these conferences, they sort of fight about, the Americans say, please shut down the brothels, keep the brothels off limits to American troops, just get rid of it. And the French say, absolutely not. Like, you cannot convince us. And so then the Americans do what they do in colonies, which is just implement it anyway. So they arrest, I mean, French officials call this both extra legal and illegal. They arrest French women who they see consorting with US soldiers. Even though, right, prostitution is legal in France if you're registered, they shut down brothels, and they really cast this, again, this wide net of surveillance, much as they did in the United States. So there's this one example in a city in France where they where there's a big military base, and military police go and they watch every single train that arrives in the city, and they basically follow every woman that gets off the train. And if they see the woman looking suspicious or talking to a soldier, they arrest her. They turn her over to the French. The French release her because she has not committed a crime. And then the American military police arrest her again. So it's this kind of harassment that they say has let the hundreds of women just leave the area because of it, because they don't want to be subject to this kind of harassment. And in France, they also, I have one case that I found of them performing a invasive genital exam on a woman just because someone, a U.S. Soldier said, oh, she gave me the clap. And this woman and her family write to the U.S. military government and say, you know, basically like I've been raped. But through this examination with a speculum, I've lost my honor. So for French women, right, this policy falls very, very hard on the bodies of French women in order to, again, keep this sort of image of American white male strength and sexual purity, even though what was happening on the ground was, as we know, a lot of sex.
Yeah, and it's interesting that the social role that the prostitute plays is someone who could be impressed and just used as an object across races, and so it's just equalizing in a terrible mm-hmm. state.
So I think civilizational discourse is really key to this, and is really an important part of kind of progressive era thinking. These ideas of civilizational hierarchies, and this idea that they might be a little bit mutable, that you can, with help, kind of help with the right American help, some countries could progress along towards civilization. And so in that way, right, even though the French are white, they're still uncivilized. So they still require the same kind of intervention that uncivilized people of color do, even though right, uncivilized people of color are also, because of racism, treated worse.
Always, always the case. Let's wrap up with this League of Nations and this sort of ASHA policy trying to go global. So what happens there? So famously, the U.S. isn't officially in the league, though it does participate in a lot of league groupings. So maybe you could let us know what happened there.
Well, so yeah, after World War One, all of the members of the American Social Hygiene Association, right, who have been involved in the war effort, they're like, the war was amazing. We're doing great. We have all this experience cooperating with the government. We're cooperating with foreign governments. We're sending our materials all over the world. And so when, right, at the kind of formation of the League of Nations, they help get the traffic in women put into the covenant of the League of Nations. Now, there are a lot of people who want it put in, but these American reformers are also pushing it, right? And they're all friends with Woodrow Wilson. So when the U.S. doesn't join the League of Nations, it's a little bit of a setback, but Americans funded by John D. Rockefeller Jr. say, you know what, let's do an investigation. They propose a big American-style investigation into the traffic in women in North and South America, in Europe, in North Africa, and then eventually in the Middle East, South Asia, East Asia. And they, right, they run this investigation much like they did their investigations into prostitution during World War One. So they travel around and they document thousands of instances of migratory sexual labor, often done in really hard conditions, like particularly for women migrants, that was what work looked like. But what they hear, like if you read their raw notes, it's so interesting because across the board, women are saying, I make more money here. I make more money in less time. I can control my hours. I'm my own boss. Yes, I have to pay bribes to the police. but this is the best option for me in a very constrained world of options. But again, what Americans do is they take all that evidence and they apply this American lens to it that says prostitution and trafficking are the same thing. And so they take this study back to the League of Nations and they say, we've found widespread evidence of trafficking. And here's what will solve it: immigration restriction and broader criminalization of commercial sex. And so those policies get kind of put into League of Nations agreements that come later, right, that end up, there's a 1933 agreement that really follows U.S. law in collapsing prostitution and trafficking and really not leaving room for a kind of category of chosen consensual migratory sex work. And then after the Second World War, those conventions or those become part of the United Nations. So they're really the framework that we live with today. The UN is more recently kind of pushing back against that a little bit, but the US government is doing everything it can to continue that perspective.
So maybe just a final question. Where does that leave us in the 2020s? What should listeners take away that we're all under the yoke of evangelical Protestant anti-prostitution policies from the mid to late 19th century still today? But beyond that, what should listeners sort of take from this?
I mean, I think an interesting thing about this current moment, really about the, you know, last 20 years and particularly like with the internet, is right. So when I did this research, trying to find out what women who sold sex thought about and understood what was happening to them in the 1870s and in the 1920s even, is really hard, right? It requires huge amounts of digging in archives all over the country and in Europe and in Latin America. But now, we actually have lots of sex worker organizations, sex worker activists, sex worker scholars who are saying a lot of the same things that sex workers have been saying since the 1870s, which is that they want safe workplaces, that they want labor protections, right? That they can make more money selling sex than other kinds of work, that this is a best option among a lot of hard options for many women in very precarious situations. And so, I mean, I think now our takeaway can be that we can listen to what sex workers say, and what they say will make them less vulnerable to trafficking, right? Because they are saying it, and they're saying it very loudly, that this idea that all prostitution is trafficking is really unhelpful. This attack on prostitution, kind of U.S. prohibitionist prostitution policy, enables trafficking. U.S. immigration policy enables trafficking, and makes the lives of vulnerable women more difficult.
Eva, that's a great place to end, if a depressing one. Thank you so much for joining us. Everyone, check out her book, Empire of Purity. And thanks again, and we'd love to have you back on again soon.
Thank you so much.
Going to the gym can be discouraging, especially if you're putting in the work but barely seeing changes. But with Tonal, you can actually see your progress with every workout. Tonal provides the convenience of a full gym and the expertise of a personal trainer anytime at home with one sleek system. Designed to reduce your mental load, Tonal is the ultimate strength training system, helping you focus less on workout planning and more on getting results. No more second-guessing your technique. Tonal gives you real-time coaching cues to dial in your form and help you lift safely and effectively. After a quick assessment, Tonal sets the optimal weight for every move and adjusts in 1 pound increments as you get stronger, so you're always challenged. Tonal lets you choose from a variety of expert-led workouts, from strength to aero hit to yoga and mobility to keep you coming back for more. For a limited time, go to Tonal.com to get $500 off your Tonal purchase, plus a free 4-year warranty. That's Tonal.com for $500 off, plus a free 4-year warranty. Tonal.com.